Introduction. Segment 1. Human life is eternal. Human life really is eternal. You never began and you never will end. As I've tried to come up with the simplest way to teach you this most essential fact, I've settled on 15 very brief lessons that build on one another. Let's begin here. My name is Roberta Grimes. I'm a business attorney by profession and an afterlife researcher by passion. For close to a decade now, I've been hosting Seek Reality as a podcast dedicated to helping you figure out everything related to death and the afterlife. But I want to make this easy for you. So now Seek Reality Online gives you a simple way to finally learn everything you need to know about death, the afterlife, and all of non-material reality besides. This is an exciting time to be alive. For the first time in human history, at last we have enough knowledge to develop an understanding of what really happens after we die. No need anymore to believe or to hope. Now, for the first time, we can know. But this is such a gigantic topic. In order to begin to make sense of it, what we've got to figure out is not only what happens to us after our bodies die, but also how it happens, where it happens, and even why it happens. We've got to treat this whole field as a science. And we can do that. There is every bit as much evidence for life after death as there is evidence for any of the other scientific theories that we accept as fact. But you don't know that, because for more than a century, the mainstream scientific community has refused to study any of the afterlife evidence. This is such a sad and pointless problem. And because the stonewalling continues, some of the world's leading afterlife scholars have decided to share the truth with you now, without waiting any longer for scientists to catch up. You deserve to know what we know, and you deserve to know it now. Seek Reality Online is your primary resource for all things afterlife. We want to make it as easy as we can for you to learn the wonderful truth about your own eternal life. So the core of Seek Reality Online is this evidence-based course of 15 videos. It'll always be free, so you can watch or listen to each episode as often as you like. Our big goal for Seek Reality Online is to help as many people as possible to become certain that an afterlife awaits us all, and it is truly and completely glorious. I'm going to tell you here only what we know or very strongly suspect, but there is a great deal more that we're still learning, and all of it is wonderful. I'm thrilled to be able to inform you that reality seems to contain no negative surprises at all. So as you learn the truth, you might find that you want to dig deeper and learn even more. In which case, we'll be glad to welcome you to join us as a member of Seek Reality Online. For the price of, barely one sandwich per month, you can feast on the endless truth. What afterlife researchers have discovered is a gigantic greater reality of which this whole material universe is, believe it or not, just a tiny part. And in studying that greater reality, we are learning so many important and really fantastic brand new things. Do you want to know what creates this universe and keeps it going? Or why we bother to come to Earth at all? Do you wonder how it's possible for dozens or hundreds of other realities to exist right where we are now? And what about God? Is there a God? And if there really is a God, then what is God like? As time goes on, we'll be giving you the option of exciting new courses in many fields, as well as online meetings and events. We want you to have the chance to learn everything that we have spent our lives learning. The next segment in this series will introduce some of the most important kinds of afterlife evidence. And the third introductory segment will give you a crash course in the master energy that underlies all of reality. Then will come four more primary topics, each with three segments. We'll be talking about the design and functioning of the greater reality, what the afterlife is like, and how it works, the state of play and afterlife communication, and how you can best achieve the learning and growth, which is the reason why you even came to Earth at all. Your life on earth may be stressful, but your eternal life is lived in more beauty and love and joy than you can imagine. There is nothing for you to fear. You are forever safe in everlasting arms. The people behind Seek Reality Online are scholars who have spent our lives learning the greatest of all possible truths. And now it is our happy task to give you this liberating gift. Welcome to Seek Reality Online. You are a powerful, eternal being. You never began and you never will end. Segment 2, Sources of Afterlife Information. There is so much wonderful afterlife evidence, but in considering any evidence for anything, it's important that we always be skeptical. There are phenomena that seem to be afterlife evidence, but in fact, they're nothing of the kind. And there also is some good evidence that probably never has occurred to you. Many of the usual methods of scientific inquiry don't work in doing afterlife research, in part because our own emotions will affect our experimental results, and also because the people that we used to think were dead are playing now by very different rules. I'm going to share with you what I consider to be the best sources of afterlife evidence, although, of course, they aren't the only sources. Then, if your interest is piqued, you can delve into studying all the afterlife evidence available to you in the members section. But first, let's discuss some popular forms of evidence that can be useful only if we understand their limitations. First and foremost, near-death experiences are wonderful evidence that our minds can function easily apart from our bodies. Each NDE is a gift to the experiencer. But since those having NDEs are only general visitors to the astral plane and they never go to where the dead are, what they can tell us about actual life after death is really very limited. Ghost stories, too, and manifestation tales are evidence that something amazing is going on, but we must be careful about trusting them, just as we would be careful about crediting random anecdotes in every other field of serious inquiry. Our best sources of afterlife evidence always are the testimony of people that we used to think were dead. We've been getting great communications in recent years from a few tested sources who have shed their physical bodies. But what first convinced me the afterlife is real was a group of hundreds of communications that were received from the dead during the 7 decades that ended about 1940. That was the amazing heyday of deep trance mediums and other physical mediums and channels. These folks possessed abilities that apparently are latent in many of us, but very few who are living today have the time or the patience to develop them. The best of these mediums were extraordinary, and there were serious researchers working back then with the greatest physical mediums to deliver proofs of life after death that should have been enough to satisfy even the most exacting scientists. Sadly, though, mainstream scientists of the day were so rattled when they first were presented with all this great evidence that life continues after death that they stonewalled it. Since then, for a further 100 years, they have simply ignored it altogether. I began my afterlife research 50 years ago with some of the books written by researchers who were working with physical mediums in southern England and in the eastern United States in the late 19th and the early 20th centuries. In the 1970s, you still could find their books in libraries and in used bookstores, so I read hundreds of communications from dead people. Some of them were amazingly detailed, and no two were alike. But every one of them described the same process, the same physics, the same pastimes, the same clothing and scenery, the same everything. You really had to be there. I say in The Fun of Dying that it was like reading a lot of accounts by travelers to Fiji. I kept coming across all the same details, but always said a bit differently. It was astounding. Achieving results like that at random would have been nearly impossible. Within 2 years, I was transformed from someone highly skeptical that an afterlife ever might be discoverable to the eager researcher that I still am today. On the other hand, though, more recent communications received through mental mediums are of little value as evidence. That's also true of cases where a dead young person talks through his mother. Most of these modern communications through mothers can't be trusted as evidence since the young folks just don't know very much. Although there is one such mother-son pair in which the son claims to be a sixth-level being, and Mikey Morgan has easily passed all our tests, he has proven to be a source of very consistent new information. Scientific articles and published papers also can be useful. The dimensions where the dead are and this material dimension all are interwoven, so materialist scientists keep finding the ways in which everything fits together. For example, afterlife researchers couldn't make sense of the physics of the afterlife until we began to get good quantum physics for dummies books at the start of this century. And finally, we have the testimony of someone who lived 2,000 years ago and claimed to know what's really going on. You'll see Jesus mentioned here not as a religious figure, but as a witness who validates a lot of the modern information. And there are not sufficient numerals to calculate the odds against chance for that. You should never take anything on trust. But if you spend enough time with the evidence, you can become as sure as we are sure that you are a powerful, eternal being. And now, let's learn what's behind it all. Segment 3. Consciousness is the base creative force. The fundamental fact of human life is this. What you and I experience in a dim way as human consciousness is apparently the only thing that exists. The evidence is amazingly strong that everything else that we think is real is created by consciousness, composed of consciousness, and set in place by consciousness. There is nothing else. And our minds are all part of that same base consciousness energy. The great Max Planck won the 1918 Nobel Prize as an important quantum physics pioneer. And fully 90 years ago, he said, "I regard consciousness as fundamental. I regard matter as derivative from consciousness. We cannot get behind consciousness. Everything that we talk about, everything that we regard as existing, postulates consciousness." Then toward the end of his life, Dr. Planck summed up his greatest discovery by saying, "As a man who has devoted his whole life to the most clear-headed science, to the study of matter, I can tell you as a result of my research about atoms this much. There is no matter as such. All matter originates and exists only by virtue of a force which brings the particle of an atom to vibration and holds this most minute solar system of the atom together. We must assume behind this force the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind. This mind is the matrix of all matter." And now we know that he was precisely right. Grasping the central role of consciousness makes it easier for us to understand what happens when we die, and it helps us begin to understand so much more. Accepting the primary role of consciousness allows us to begin to understand a lot of things that otherwise never will be explained. We'll be talking more about the primacy of consciousness as this series unfolds, although you should know that researchers still are trying to make a better sense of what consciousness even is. Here is where a more open-minded scientific community might be helpful, but in fact, mainstream science has been a closed-minded belief system for more than a century. Mainstream scientists are allowed to study only matter, believe it or not, matter and material energy, and that's it. The university departments and the peer-reviewed journals still refuse to support any scientist who wants to look into anything that is deemed to be not material. In fact, mainstream science is so determined to prove that Dr. Planck was mistaken when he said that consciousness is fundamental that $1 billion is now being wasted in trying to find a source of consciousness inside the human brain. which is the rough equivalent, of course, of disassembling an old transistor radio to try to find the source of Elvis Presley's voice. But fortunately, as this generation of afterlife researchers continues to put it all together, we are learning to do this work without scientific help. Although the fact that scientists continue to ignore most of reality has gotten old, to be frank, after 100 years. So we have given up waiting for the mainstream scientific gatekeepers to abandon their insistence that reality has to be whatever they say it is. And that's why we are sharing these truths with you now. What is consciousness anyway? The best definitions I've seen is this. Consciousness is an infinitely powerful and infinitely creative potentiality without size or form, alive in the sense that your mind is alive. It's governed by emotion and therefore it may be self-aware. Consciousness is in the nature of a non-material energy. And like all energies, it vibrates. Amazingly, it vibrates based upon what you and I experience as emotion. The vibratory rate of consciousness ranges from low and slow, which is fear, anger, hatred, grief, and all the other ishy emotions, to extremely high and rapid, which is the highest level, is perfect love. It's ironic, isn't it? Mainstream science assumes that consciousness is just a product of your material brain, and it's sure that emotions are less than nothing. But in fact, consciousness is the base force that creates everything else that we think exists, and that base creative force is governed by what we experience as emotions. Mainstream science seems to have reality exactly backward. As we go on from here and begin to understand more of the basics of what actually is going on, you will need to keep in mind three facts. First and foremost, the only thing that objectively exists is what you and I experience as human consciousness. That's it. And consciousness gives rise to and literally makes up everything that we think is real. Furthermore, consciousness is governed by the vibrations of what you and I experience as emotion. For now, simply know these three core facts for the background certainty that they are. Consciousness is basic, it gives rise to everything else, and it's governed by emotion. As we go forward with these facts in mind, you'll find yourself becoming ever more delighted as you finally discover the wonderful truth about the reality that you think you see around you. And the more you learn, the more you are going to rejoice in finally discovering the glorious eternal being that you really are. Section 2, The Design and Functioning of Reality. Segment 4, Reality from the Viewpoint of Consciousness Physics. These next three segments will consider the design and functioning of all the parts of reality that we are able to perceive and to access. And we're going to begin by looking at reality from the viewpoint of consciousness physics. There is one reality. It encompasses everything that mainstream physicists now think is real, plus a great deal more. All the parts of our one reality are so closely interwoven that there's no way to separate them, and nothing in reality is solid. Working physicists won't tell you this, but Albert Einstein will. He said, "What we have called matter is energy whose vibration has been so lowered as to be perceptible to the senses. There is no matter." And he was right. Physicists tell us that what we call matter is composed of atoms, each of which has a nucleus with orbiting subatomic particles. What they don't say out loud is that if the White House were the nucleus of an atom where it is and the size that it is, the closest orbiting electron could be as far away as Denver, and there would be nothing in between. What physicists really don't add, except in very, very fine print, is that even those subatomic nuclei in the particles orbiting inside the atom aren't solid. They are vortices of energy. It is all energy. If you could take a photograph inside an atom, you'd get a picture of nothing. And the only reason why you can't put your hand right through your desk is that the vortices of energy in your hand conflict with the vortices of energy in your desk. You're about to get a little physics course from someone who never got beyond Algebra 2. Everything I know in this field has come from decades of studying evidence for the afterlife and also reading Quantum Physics for Dummies books and popular science magazines. But the real physicists are still stubbornly stuck in their weird refusal to study anything that they deem to be not material. Even though we, of course, all know that nothing is actually material in the sense of being solid. So for now, this business attorney is forced to be a reluctant hobby physicist. Of course, like everything else in physics, what I'm about to set forth for you is a theory. But it's the only theory in physics that is grounded in all the evidence. It's also a theory that helps us to answer more of the basic questions that still vex humankind than does any other theory that ever has been put forth by any materialist physicist. It explains not only the origin of reality and the origin of life, but also how the universe developed. It explains the source and operation of our minds. It helps to explain so many things. What we'll be setting forth now is just the basics that you'll need to make sense of in order to understand the afterlife-related information. But as Seek Reality Online develops, we plan to share with you a free-ranging discussion of consciousness physics in the members section. Now, without further ado, let's dip a toe into consciousness physics. As you've already learned, consciousness is an energy-like potentiality that vibrates on an emotion-based scale, from fear at the lowest and slowest to love at the highest and fastest. And our minds are part of the same consciousness that creates the reality that we think we see around us. We all are parts of the one great mind. So your mind is forever who you are, but at the same time, it also is part of everybody else's mind. That's why mind-based communication with both the living and the dead is so easy. If you believe you can do it, then you easily can. The most important thing for you to know as we start to make sense of consciousness physics is that the physics that governs this material universe does not exist in most of reality. Matter, its correlate energy, time, and space do not exist in most of reality. This is easy to understand about matter, but am I saying that even space and time don't exist in the parts of reality governed by consciousness physics? How could that work? Well, actually, it's easy to make sense of no space. Just close your eyes and imagine a grassy plain with snow-capped mountains far away, clear blue sky. Imagine it all. Now, mount the white horse standing beside you and gallop across that plain. Hear the grass whoosh, feel the wind in your hair and the mane on your face. Okay, now open your eyes and tell me, where is that plain, the horse, the mountains, and the sky? That's right, it's all in your mind. And in a reality governed by consciousness where your own mind is part of that consciousness, everything that you think exists actually is in our great shared mind. As our wise friend Albert Einstein said, reality is merely an illusion, albeit a very persistent one. But what about time? In most of reality, there is no past or future. There is only now. You can exist in now for as long as you like, just doing things and having fun. The dead tell us that we won't be able to understand time until we actually get there. But the lack of objective time has some amazing implications for the here and now. And with this little taste of consciousness physics, let's look at how the greater reality apparently all fits together. Segment 5, the universe, the astral plane, and the afterlife. We have a lot of really good afterlife evidence, and all of it is amazingly consistent across countries and across generations. Those of us who have studied the afterlife have discovered a richly detailed reality. We're like a little group of people who have all been hiking in Tibet. And each of us separately has stumbled across Shangri-La. We are amazed, delighted, thrilled to be sharing the world's greatest secret. Because all of us realize that we have found precisely the same place. Granted, it's a complex place, and it's so different from the reality that we think we see around us now that I struggle to come up with ways to explain the relationship between this reality and that one. Here is another of the many spots where having open-minded scientists involved might be helpful, but I'll tell you what the evidence suggests is true. This is easiest for you to understand when you think of television. Right now, in the room around you, there are hundreds of TV channels. If you turn on your TV set tuned to channel 4, you can pick up the local news live as a solid-seeming reality. Then you can click to channel 5 and find another live news channel all inside that same TV. And if you think of your mind as that TV and the different dimensions of reality as all those channels, you'll have a pretty good basic understanding of how reality actually works. Right now, your mind is tuned to that body on this material-seeming level of reality. When your body dies, your mind will tune to a slightly higher consciousness vibratory rate, and it will pick up a different reality that is every bit as solid-seeming as this one is, right in the same place. And I should add, you'll also pick up a lovely new young body to enjoy. The greater reality beyond this material universe contains many different vibratory dimensions that our minds can separately access. In each of those realities may be the size of this whole physical universe. The material reality where we think we are now is apparently at the lower end of the consciousness vibratory scale. All the realities of which we are aware seem to vibrate higher than matter. And together, all those non-matter-based realities make up what we call the astral plane, which apparently is where we spend most of our eternal lives. What we generally call the afterlife is just a tiny part of the astral plane, and it also exists in a range of vibrations, from the lowest and slowest to the highest. It functions as a kind of foyer between most of reality and this material experience. We prepare to enter earth lives there, and then later we return home there. Children who die on earth grow up there. People who've been damaged on earth will be counseled and healed there. People who can't forgive themselves for their earthly mistakes will spend some extra time there in what Jesus called the outer darkness, where there is wailing and gnashing of teeth. But eventually, everyone damaged by their earth experience is rescued and healed, and all of us will graduate back to the gigantic astral plane. There are apparently hundreds of different vibratory levels in the afterlife and in the astral. For convenience, afterlife researchers have divided them into 7 aggregate levels. From lowest to highest, level 1 is what Jesus called the outer darkness. Level 2 is a kind of recovery area. It's still pretty dim. Level 3 through 5 are what the Vikings called the Summerland. They're earth-like and gorgeous beyond belief. Level 6 is the causal or teaching level. The beings there are in service to humanity as they further perfect themselves in preparation for joining the Source on level 7. Nearly everyone heading home will enter the afterlife at level 3, and nearly everyone can hold to level 3, which is an issue, since we can't comfortably go higher than the vibratory level that matches our own rate of consciousness vibration. The astral plane contains people who have not been on earth for a while, all happily enjoying their eternal lives, and also people who have left their physical bodies on earth to astral travel. And that includes you and me while our bodies sleep. It also includes people having near-death experiences. We are told by the dead that death is always a one-way trip. And those who are having extensive near-death experiences will be told the same thing as they approach the afterlife area. Turn back, because if you cross this barrier, your silver cord will break and your body will die. But the astral plane is so enormous that being barred from the afterlife area until we actually die doesn't seem to be much of a handicap. Which brings up an interesting question. Since all the realities are so densely intertwined, you'd think that scientists could find the astral plane, which might be 20 times the size of this whole material universe. and perhaps they have found it. Gravity and other factors lead them to think that the material universe is less than 5% of what exists. What they call dark matter is about 27%, and dark energy makes up 68% of what mainstream physicists now tell us is real. Why is it dark? It's dark because it's not material, so it doesn't interact with photons of light. If we were able to detect the astral plane from this material level of reality, I think that's how it might look. Don't you? Segment 6, beginning to understand who we actually are. Before we venture into discussing the death process and the afterlife details, we should give some thought to better understanding who and what you and I really are. Mainstream science's obsession with materialism makes scientists certain we are just meat robots, and our meat brains actually generate all the consciousness there is. They insist that you and I are no more important than any ant is important. When our meat bodies die, then each of us will blink out like a light. That whole scientific idea of humankind as mortal meat robot is based in the false scientific dogma of materialism, so it likely won't surprise you to learn that it is altogether wrong. And of course, all religious ideas about who we are also turn out to be wrong. The religious notion that we are sinners and deserving of God's wrath is, insofar as we can tell, the exact opposite of what is true. We're still learning more of the truth about humanity, who and what we really are. This has been a pretty hard climb for researchers, because like you, we have lived our lives steeped in the sinful meat robot concept of humankind. But the picture of us that the afterlife evidence paints is so different, and over time we have gradually come to see how amazing the truth about humanity really is. I'm going to tell you as this series unfolds what we strongly suspect is likely true, while adding the fact that what we dare to believe is likely much less wonderful than what is actually true. We live forever in more love and joy and just plain fun than we can imagine. So then, why do we come to Earth? Why does this material universe even bother to exist at all? Well, the problem seems to be that when we are at home, we want to have even a lot more fun. The astral plane, including the afterlife, is governed by the same consciousness vibration gradations from fear at the lowest to love at the highest that always apply to consciousness. And you and I also are consciousness. So you and I are vibrating too. And when we are in the astral plane and in the afterlife, the level at which we are vibrating is important. More toward fear and hatred or more toward love and joy, it matters a lot because it determines where we can go and what we can do in the afterlife and in the astral plane. Most of us seem to be vibrating around level 3 or 4, which means that we can't move higher than that. Level 5? Level 6? Unless someone who is vibrating at that higher level will accompany us, those who have tried to go higher say the energy becomes unbearable. It boxes you in the ears and smacks you in the face. But reality is more beautiful the higher you go. There's even lots more fun to be had. So each of us comes to crave more spiritual growth. From the way the not actually dead talk about it, when we are in the astral plane, the craving to grow spiritually comes to feel like every physical craving you've ever had in your life put together. And that is why this universe exists. It's designed as a place for us to grow spiritually, and we come into it with a limited subset of our vast eternal minds that is designed for rapid spiritual growth. Here's where I'm really getting a little out of my depth, but raising our personal consciousness vibrations looks from here to be a straightforward process. We'll talk about it in the final segments. Coming to Earth is something like going to a gym where you can stretch your spiritual muscles. Bad marriage, maybe, loss of a job, loss of a child. Every stressor in your life acts like a machine in a gym to strengthen specific spiritual muscles. And as you'll see, once you know that what's what life is all about, your future spiritual growth is much easier. Well, okay then. So who are we really? What are these nearly 8 billion beings who live as eternal minds in temporary meat bodies, and the countless billions more just like us who are enjoying playtime in the astral plane? Well, what we do know is this. First, each of us is a part of the same consciousness energy that manifests all of reality. And so far as we know, all other living things are at least somewhat conscious, but they're not part of the base creative consciousness as you and I are. Second, as we grow spiritually to about the top of the fifth level, we get to the point where we're able to grow spiritually while we're there, without needing to come back here. We'll then likely take on the role of guiding others who still are coming to Earth, so we can help them learn their Earth lessons too. Third, at the highest levels, we smoothly work in collectives of thousands of beings, and at the very highest level of perfected beings is the Godhead, the glorious collective that manifests everything that we think is real. And finally, the most important fact of all is this. Each of us is loved much more than any of us can possibly imagine. Each of us is something like the most precious being in all of reality. I kid you not. And I know how surprising that sounds. Each one of us is infinitely, joyously, and far beyond perfectly loved. So now with this prelude, let's dig right in and talk about the afterlife. Section 3, Death and the Afterlife. Segment 7, Seeing Death as Part of Our Eternal Lives. Until now, most of us have had no idea about what was going on. We were born with pre-birth amnesia, then eventually we died and we went back home. Only then did we remember what it had all been about. So understandably, while we are here, we tend to think of these lives on Earth as a lot more important than they actually are. From here, death has always looked like a scary trip into the unknown, and that was the best case. It's only in recent decades that afterlife researchers have more intensively studied the evidence for the greater reality of which this material universe is just a tiny part. And we've been able to make some sense of our lives on Earth within their eternal frame. Our biggest problem in trying to approach our lives from the viewpoint of the afterlife and the astral plane is the fact that there really is no time. Living in this material universe, it can seem as if time is very important. Albert Einstein may or may not have said the only reason for time is so everything doesn't happen at once. And that's how the time issue looks to us. You've got to have time. But we know now that the billions of people living in the astral plane are living their eternal lives just fine without any sort of arrow of time running. And just as an aside, right about here, we ought to mention reincarnation. The notion that we live many lives is only now becoming accepted in the West. But apparently what happens is more complicated than just repeated births and deaths. From here, we can see just a limited part of a complex process based in love that we are told isn't going to make sense to us until we arrive back home. What seems to be the case, though, is that the separations that we perceive between people are far less rigid than we think they are, and much of what we think of as reincarnation amounts to the blending and sharing of life experiences. For now, I'll just answer two questions that many people have about reincarnation. First, you should know that we don't just quickly flip into and out of lives on Earth. Your loved ones will be waiting for you, even if they died 50 years before you do. And you should know, too, that you really are eternal. The awareness that you have, that sense of being alive, which is what you actually think of as you, that really never is going to die. Okay, so let's talk now about the lifetime you are presently living. We don't know every detail of what happens, but we do know quite a lot. The lack of time running in most of reality means that some of our Earth lives are lived out of order. We plan our lives to happen where we can have the experiences that will allow us to achieve the kinds of growth that we need. We even are told that every one of our lives is somehow being lived at the same time. But we don't need to think about any of that now. Instead, let's just examine the process of cycling into and out of one life on earth. And because it's our eternal lives that are important and not these brief trips to what Craig Hogan calls Earth School, we're going to approach talking about our lives and deaths on earth from the viewpoint of the eternal astral reality, which is where we actually live nearly all the time. We generally plan our lives on earth with people from our own soul group. We all belong to soul groups and to collectives of soul groups that can amount to thousands of people. And coming into a lifetime with people we know can make our adjustment to life on earth easier. We also each will have a spirit guide whose job it is to help us get the best and most effective spiritual growth from this lifetime. And often our spirit guide will be a dear eternal friend who is a bit more spiritually advanced than we are. My own guide tells me that he and I have shared 17 Earth lifetimes, and I think our story is typical. If you wonder why bad things happen to good people, we do indeed plan a lot of the bad things that happen in our lives. We don't want easy lives. We want as many challenges as we can get, so we can grow by a lot in just one go. Many of us plan such stress-filled lives that our guides submit our life plans to a council of elders, and the elders will crank things back a bit. Okay, so your whole family dies in a house fire and you're arrested for arson, although you didn't do it. Fair enough. But you can't also be a quadriplegic. They worry that our trying to take on too much at once is going to break us spiritually rather than helping us grow. So then our shared plan is accepted. We all get ready to enter our upcoming earth lives, where we will be one another's friends, enemies, spouses, parents, children, and so on. Among other things, we go through a process of shrinking to a fetus and shedding most access to our vast eternal minds. And we attach ourselves to our new body as soon as it is conceived. And we wait. Many of us don't spend much time in the body of the fetus until it's close to being born. Then eventually we are pushed out into the world, into the gravity and pain and grief and fear that we had happily forgotten all about until now. No wonder newborn babies cry. Segment 8, the process of dying and transitioning. So we are born on earth and we live our lives. Then eventually it'll be time to go home. When we plan a life on Earth, we also plan 2 or 3 exit points that our higher consciousness can choose to take if it decides that it has already wrung whatever value it can get from this lifetime. One possible exit point might be in our youth. One might be in our 40s or 50s, and one in old age. And sometimes we'll leave the lifetime even before we're born. Especially if things change in the family or community while we are in gestation, we have the right to decide not to go ahead. Then usually someone else will take that fetus. There are many more beings wanting earth bodies than there are bodies available. But if someone else doesn't step in soon enough, a healthy baby will be stillborn. Nearly all of us, though, will go through with birth and the lifetime that follows it. Our primary guide works hard to help us hit the marks of a life plan of which we have no conscious memory. We owe a lot to our main guide. He or she is our coach, our cheerleader, and our best friend. As my own guide likes to remind me, he gets a lot of learning and growth himself from guiding someone who is trying hard and is overachieving. No pressure at all, just saying. But then, eventually, an exit point is approaching that our higher consciousness has chosen to take. We generally know, on a subconscious level, about a year before that exit point that our life on Earth is ending. It's subtle, but those we love can see it after the fact. People spend time winding things up, healing wounds and rifts, reconnecting with friends, and making sure that the spouse knows all the passwords. There's no urgency associated with these actions. It generally seems that the person leaving had no idea about what was coming. But nevertheless, when people share stories at the celebration of that person's life, there can be some aha moments. Our bodies resist dying. They can die in an accident, and a lot of younger planned deaths happen that way. Since we're out of our bodies before the impact, a fatal auto crash is an easy way to transition. But most people die of some sort of disease or of old age, and either kind of death can be a long and uncomfortable process. As many people who didn't like the title of my book, The Fun of Dying, have pointed out to me. Eventually, though, our body is weakened enough that death is at last approaching, and that is when things start to get interesting. We should again point out that people who have near-death experiences never actually die. No one who comes back to tell the tale has ever been to where the dead go when they first transition back home. So NDE experiences can tell us nothing at all about genuine death. We should add that some who die at what are not planned exit points may go off track for a time. We can't learn much from those deaths either. But we estimate that more than 3/4 of those who transition back home will have a planned death that happens at a planned exit point, and their deaths will all be amazingly similar. A day or two before a planned death, there will often be a period of what looks like partial recovery. Pain will lessen. People might express hunger, or they might want to talk. This is seen by doctors as a sign that the transition process has begun. Then soon thereafter, there may be a period of what is called terminal lucidity. People with advanced senility and people who might have been comatose might wake up and seem to be entirely normal. And for a few hours, they might sit up happy and pain-free and converse with the people around them. It's at about this time that the earliest deathbed visitors will generally show up. One or several loved ones who may have died long before will appear to the dying person, often in the upper corners of the room. They will look terrific, young and happy, and they'll talk with their dying loved one in their minds. At this point, many of the dying will stop communicating with those around the bed, but instead they'll lie gazing at an upper corner of the room as they mentally talk with their visitors. It's only a matter of hours then before the active transition begins. People who were awake through the death process tell us that our outer body, which is staying behind, separates from the inner nested energy body that's leaving. This process begins in the fingers and toes and progresses up the extremities and then up the body. It feels like lots of little threads breaking. It doesn't hurt, but it does feel funny. Then the energy that is you gathers in the chest, and it leaves the body as a gray mist that seems to disappear as its vibratory rate rises. Out of sight of the living, it forms into a body in the air, and there are some wonderful reunions. But once you are out of your body, the silver energy cord that kept it alive soon frays and breaks. That is the actual moment of death. Your deathbed visitors are urging you to come away and not try to interact with those around the bed, because if you focus on the living, you'll lose your ability to follow the dead. And then you can become stuck in place for years, even occasionally centuries, until you are eventually rescued. But fortunately, having heard these words, you know that you'd better go with those who come for you, so you do that gladly. Segment 9, the period soon after death. Once you are out of your body, you'll quickly leave the scene of your death in the company of your mother, perhaps, your spouse, maybe a childhood pet. As you rise in vibration in North America, you might well enter a grayish fog. In other cultures, you could walk through a wall or across a bridge, but you look back at your deathbed with your loved ones around it, and you notice that the room and those in it are looking vague and vapory, and then as you continue to rise in vibration, it all disappears. And right before you, the fog clears to reveal a glorious scene. The beautiful, beautiful reception areas of the afterlife turn out to be culturally specific. If you die in China, for example, you might see idealized imperial gardens and pagodas. but nearly all the reliable surviving communications from the late 19th and early 20th centuries were received in southern England and in the eastern United States. So the two reception areas of which we have a lot of descriptions are similar. The English one looks something like elegant Victorian gardens and buildings. The American one has some classic and some very modern buildings, also formal gardens, gorgeous trees, lots of flowers as tall as people, and in the distance, tree-covered foothills and the snow-capped Rocky Mountains. Some people simply die in their sleep, and they wake up in a house that is so solid and normal that it could be hard to convince them they have actually died. Some will have died physically sick or emotionally damaged, and they go to care homes where they are helped to feel well again. That's a process that can take a few earth months. But those who die awake and without a need for rehab will go with their deathbed visitors into a beautiful reception garden. There they can sit on a stone bench and enjoy all the flowers and colors never seen on earth, and the pure white light, the bird song, all the fountains splashing. People who have had this experience report how overwhelmingly joyous it feels to be safe in such a beautiful place. Maybe holding hands with a long-dead spouse and stroking a childhood cat. Very soon, the superconscious part of our mind that we left behind when we entered that lifetime merges with our conscious mind. We have all our old knowledge and memories back. We recall other lifetimes. We recognize old friends. We hug our spirit guide, who turns out to be a very, very dear eternal friend. Contrary to our expectations, the afterlife isn't crowded at all. Instead, it is inconceivably gigantic. And since travel is by mind and instantaneous, we can live isolated from one another and still spend lots of time together. What happens soon after we arrive in the afterlife is quite individual, but two things will happen. We will party hardy, and we will experience a life review, which is the closest thing to post-death judgment that we ever will see. Your life review can be formal, in a big stone building before a council, your guides, and others who are important in your life, or it can happen in your own living room with just your primary guide for support. Either way, you will experience a kind of hologram of your entire life, but from the perspective of all the people you affected. You get to feel how you made everyone else feel. And then you are asked to forgive them all. And you do. Even a concentration camp guard at Auschwitz? Yes. With all your loved ones right there with you, everyone knows it was all a kind of play. I have never read an account of a life review in which someone balked at forgiving others. But the problem is that once you have forgiven everyone else, you also are asked to forgive yourself. And that's the hard part. The most important thing you can do for yourself while on earth is really learn how to forgive. Because if you don't manage to forgive yourself after you die for everything that you did in this lifetime, your consciousness vibration will gradually slow. And if you can't halt the slide, you will end up in what Jesus called the outer darkness, where there is wailing and gnashing of teeth. But of course, you have forgiven everyone. And meanwhile, at your ancestral homestead, people are starting to arrive. People you were close to in this life, people you knew in other lifetimes, a lot of people want to come and be there and welcome you home. Our post-death bodies lack internal organs, but you and I are used to food and drink, so refreshments will be served. Whatever you ingest just disappears. There could be entertainment. Maybe John Lennon will even show up and sing Imagine. There are lots of reports of him performing, as well as Elvis and Frank Sinatra and others. But you were a big John Lennon fan, and when he gets to Imagine There's No Heaven, that's a laugh line. Your post-death life is a kind of R&R playtime that goes on for as long as you like. You can drive cars and boats and airplanes, all powered by mind, so there's no exhaust. You can investigate whatever you like in gigantic libraries that include holograms of all kinds of events. You can learn crafts, learn to play an instrument or sing, attend performances by people who were big on Earth, or even perform yourself if you like. There are amusement parks where you can play at Dickensian England or the Wild Wild West or other places, and you can travel to the ends of the material universe. Travel is a big thing there. You won't even remember what fun can be until you are living again as who you truly are. Endless joy is your eternal home and with all your wonderful eternal friends. Section 4, Communicating with the Dead. Segment 10, After-Death Signs and How They Are Delivered. When we die, we usually leave loved ones behind, so one of the first things we want to do after death is to send back messages. It's as if we had moved to another planet. We want to let the home folks know that we've arrived safely, having a wonderful time, wish you were here, that sort of thing. Although actually, once we transition, we don't miss the living much at all. The physics are such that we can lower our consciousness vibrations whenever we like, so we can be right there with them. But we can feel their distress and we want to ease it, so we send them signs from a predictable list. This problem of wanting to comfort the grieving is both ancient and universal, and the ways that Neanderthals and Cro-Magnons solved it are still in common use today with the modern addition of our ability to mess with electricity. Let's look at what our newly dead loved ones are likely to do for us. Most commonly, they give us what are called apports. They dematerialize small objects at a different time and place and drop them where we can find them. To this day, the most common apports are feathers and coins. And those coins are probably stand-ins for the pebbles of Cro-Magnon days. If you're suddenly finding feathers everywhere, or if you find 20 pennies or nickels one day unexpectedly, you can assume those are signs from your departed loved one. Or they influence butterflies or dragonflies to hang around you, maybe alighting on your shirt. They even might fill your whole backyard. My own mother did something amazing with insects. A few mornings after her death, in the heat of an August day, she filled my backyard with thousands of dragonflies. The next morning, there were no dragonflies at all, but instead there were thousands of butterflies of all kinds. Then the third morning, it was dragonflies again. On the fourth morning, there were no insects at all, but when I went outside, a single dragonfly and a single orange butterfly flew side by side from right to left in front of my face. The dead can influence birds and animals, too. The most common bird signs are brightly colored small birds, typically cardinals and blue jays in North America. In other parts of the world, they'll be whichever birds are most likely to be noticed. These birds will perch outside your window, perhaps hang around for days, or they might fly across the road right in front of your windshield. Or a squirrel might come and sit at your feet and look up at you, calm and unafraid. Another kind of sign that might date back for eons is scent signs. These are most likely to happen in just the first year after a death. You might unexpectedly get a whiff of grandma's perfume or her ethnic cooking or grandpa's pipe. Just whatever scents are most likely to call them to mind. But electrical signs are new in the last century and they can be amazing. Our loved ones are energy beings, so they can easily mess with electricity. Soon after a loved one's death, for example, the TV might keep blinking off or on. Streetlights overhead will go off as you walk under them. My brother-in-law made a defective kitchen spotlight unexpectedly start working again, and when I tested him by name, he made it blink off and on and repeatedly at my request. And then there is a whole world of synchronicities that our loved ones can deliver. They tell us that the primary reason why all these amazing things work so well is that those not in bodies are not affected by time. But they certainly are able to mess with things. They will make the song you danced to at your wedding 40 years ago be unexpectedly playing when you walk into a store, or playing on the radio when you get in your car. They often do things like making rainbows appear for their mourners as everyone is leaving the church, or they produce a break in rain clouds and a peak of sunshine just as everyone is gathering at the graveside. When these things happen, mourners generally think it's just a happy coincidence. But we're told by those not in bodies that actual coincidences are rare. So when these things happen, we always should thank our deceased loved one. Most dramatic are actual visions of the person who has died, and believe it or not, such visions are common. Generally, they're waist high or chest high. The person looks healthy and smiling, but seldom speaks. More than half of widows and widowers will see such a vision within the first year after a spouse's death. Or sometimes our loved one will appear in a crowd or come to us in a vivid dream. If we don't acknowledge these common signs, our loved one will soon stop sending them. But if we say, "Thank you, please do it again," we can start a happy new relationship with them that can comfort us until it's our turn to go home. Segment 11, mediums. But we want more than just signs from the dead. What about communication through mediums? When I began to do afterlife research 50 years ago, I was an extreme skeptic. Then, while browsing in a used bookstore one day, I found a few old books by researchers who had been working with deep trance mediums and other physical mediums. As I have said, the late 19th and early 20th centuries were the heyday of a kind of mediumship that takes many years to develop. So it's almost non-existent today. In most instances of physical mediumship, the medium goes into trance and completely withdraws from her body. And the medium's guide in spirit, who is called a control, either speaks to us while he has our loved one right there with him, or he fosters our dead loved ones taking over the medium's body and speaking to us using her vocal cords. This kind of mediumship was amazingly evidential. No one has to mind read, no need to use symbols. And there in the room while those seances were being held were researchers who were taking notes so they could write the books that would end up in a used bookstore for us to find decades later. I scoured many used bookstores and libraries. 50 years ago, it became my obsession to read every such book that I could find. And by the end of 2 years, I had gone from being a complete skeptic to becoming an almost convinced and eager afterlife researcher. I had discovered the afterlife. All the hundreds of readings described in those books were received in various places in southern England and the eastern United States over decades, and yet all the dead who were reporting to us were describing precisely the same place, the same process, the same physics, the same pastimes, the same scenery, and all the same details, the same everything. In hundreds of different afterlife communications, I never found an outlier. So yes, physical mediumship works, but sadly, there are very few physical mediums who are working today, and almost none of them perform in public. So most of us are limited to using mental mediums. People who are able to mind read with the dead. Since we know that all our minds are part of one universal mind, mental mediumship ought to work just fine. But here, to be frank, after decades of testing, I honestly have achieved a mixed bag. What we want from any kind of medium is specific details that it would be impossible for anyone to guess, even just one tiny private detail. We want to hear something that could only have come directly from our dead loved one. And all those century-old readings through physical mediums were full of amazing details that were both unique and easily validated. One communicator who sticks in my mind was a crusty fellow who had been watching his family hunt for his will. As soon as he got control of the medium, he blurted in her voice, but with his own cranky intonation, something like, "Of course I left a will. It's in my bottom left drawer, right where I said it was. But who put all that clothing on top of it? Why doesn't anybody listen to me?" The author of this compilation of readings had checked afterward, and he reported that the will had been found exactly where the communicator had said that it was. And that's the sort of experience we all want to have with mediums. Dead, same cranky personality and some bit of good evidence that we can check. But modern mental mediumship is very seldom so precise. The best it can do is to communicate things like my mother saying she's glad she has good eyebrows now so she doesn't have to paint them on, or my mother-in-law saying she no longer needs glasses. Both were evidential details about the communicators, but they weren't nearly as snazzy as that cranky man. I smiled, though, when the first thing my mother said through a medium was, "You were right about everything!" It was a private joke. I had read The Fun of Dying to her on her deathbed, and she had flat refused to believe a word of it. She also added chattily through the medium that now she was traveling widely, checking all my work, which is just what my mother would have done, but still it's not really evidential. I have to say, though, that I hear some wonderful stories from people who have favorite mental mediums, and triple and quadruple blind experiments conducted by Dr. Gary Schwartz and others have established beyond doubt that the talent is real. In fact, it runs in families. Nearly every good medium has it on at least one side of the family and some on both sides. There is no doubt at all that mental mediumship works. So I have been frustrated by the fact that in dozens of readings I have had so few that I thought were much good at all, and I have come to see that the fault is my own. I simply can't get past the fact that mental mediums are mind reading with dead people. What are the odds that could actually work? Our own minds are extremely powerful, and they are directly involved when we consult a medium, so no matter how I've tried to suppress my skepticism, I'm pretty sure that I have been unconsciously sabotaging the work of all but a few of the most gifted mental mediums. So please don't mind me. Just get referrals. Try some mental mediums for yourself. And whatever you do, when you go for a reading, try to keep an open mind. Segment 12, The Future of Afterlife Communication. Those of us who have studied the evidence enough that we know the afterlife is real have been frustrated by all the ongoing scientific stonewalling. And it continues to happen even today. What will it take to shame our most trusted institution into at least looking at the afterlife evidence? We have come to think that what we are going to need is one undeniable smoking gun, something like an app that will let you ring up dead Aunt Mildred and get her secret recipe. And it may be that nothing less than that will do it. In order to shame all these matter-based scientists into investigating the possibility that the afterlife is real, we might need a way for everyone to talk with their dead loved ones just as an everyday thing. Then scientists will have to look at the evidence, or else they'll be laughed right out of existence. But as I said when you and I began this course together, I don't really think anymore that we've necessarily got to wait for some breakthrough miracle of easy communication with the not really dead so we can bludgeon the scientific community over its collective heads. What may be even better is just what we're doing now, just sharing with one another the simple evidence-based truth about what actually is going on. Let the truth go viral. Everyone used to wonder, and now we know what's true about the afterlife and about our own eternal natures. If each of us will learn what we can and will encourage others to learn as well, then eventually some of the younger members of the scientific community are going to feel the need to look into what we've all been talking about. If only because they have careers ahead and they want their whole careers to be relevant. With all of that said, some new and better means of communication may be on the horizon. There are two methods being developed now that look especially promising. Neither is anything to write home about yet, and both can be plagued by the same problem that I've had with getting good readings from mental mediums. Our own minds are involved. So if you are a skeptic, the powers of your mind can actually block your success. Look at me. I know for certain that the afterlife is real. It's just a few kinds of evidence that I'm still not really sure about. And even that level of skepticism is enough to get in the way. The first of these two hopeful new methods of communication is called induced afterlife communication. It's something you can learn to do on your own. Our wonderful friend, Dr. R. Craig Hogan, has been instrumental in developing this technique. And all the instructions are available for free on the Afterlife Research and Education Institute, or AREI, website. What happens is that we learn to foster genuine visits with dead loved ones in our minds that are so real that these visits can ease our grief substantially. I've talked with people who have learned the technique, and their testimony is remarkable. They have no doubt that the visits are real. Some who had been in deep grief have told me their grief had been reduced by 90% or more in just 1 2-hour session. Learning how to do it right is still a difficult process, but as it develops and becomes easier, this new technique does show a lot of promise. And the other likely new field of afterlife communication is the broad area of instrumental trance communication, or ITC, which means talking with the dead via the use of electronic devices. This method has a rich history over the past 50 years, and we've learned quite a bit about what works best. First and foremost, we've learned that in the field of ITC, the experimenter's attitude and intentions are extremely important. The foremost people working in the field of instrumental trance communication are not the living experimenters, but instead it's the dead experts who are calling the shots. The living are just their lab assistants, and the dead can easily read our minds, so they know which living experimenters have a selfless commitment to this field and which are just hoping to win wealth and fame. They know our hearts. And anyone who sees ITC work as a route to riches is going to lose the help of the dead and get nowhere. We know that communicating between dimensions of reality is always going to be hard. Think of your Channel 4 newsman and your Channel 5 newsman. Trying to chat with one another directly without cell phones while they're both on air. Then you'll get a better sense of the problems we face. They are at almost exactly the same vibration, but close is not close enough. And even though they have trouble talking with one another, both of your newscasters are alive and real. And the same is true of you and your dead Aunt Mildred. So we know that in the end, we're going to figure this out. But for now, let's do what's possible now. Let's use the evidence to figure out just where Aunt Mildred is, and let's share with all the rest of humanity what actually is going on. And meanwhile, a new world is dawning. After we have internalized the truth about the afterlife and the greater reality, we can at last begin to answer humankind's long-term greatest questions. What's it all about? Why does the universe exist? Is there a God? Where do we fit in? And why are we even here at all? Segment 13. What's it all about? One of my greatest pleasures in doing this work has been figuring out why we enter these earth lives. People have always wondered. Curiosity is our most appealing trait. While other creatures were focusing on avoiding predators and finding food, we were noticing things. The way the wind made a leaf skitter on a pond, or trying things. Wow, look how this rock cracked and made an edge. Wonder if I can do that myself, or arguing about things. The sun must have a way to get through the ground, or how can it rise again the next morning? But it can't go through dirt. That must be a new sun each morning. Well, eventually we did figure that one out. It's our great curiosity more than any other factor that makes human beings adventurous and daring. But of course, when the scientific community decides more than a century ago to shift from the open-minded pursuit of the truth to becoming just another human-made belief system, it made further progress on any front a lot harder. The material reality that we see around us and the non-material realities, which are our real home, are so densely interwoven with one another that if you insist on studying only the material aspects of reality, you make it impossible to figure out lots of things. How life began, for example, where consciousness comes from, even how the universe actually began, since wondering what existed before the Big Bang is still a problem. How did something come from nothing? Our most important questions can be answered only from a position of open-minded inquiry, and that simply does not exist anymore in the scientific community. And even beyond the limitations of materialist science, there are religion-based and cultural limitations as well. At this point, there are lots of questions that none of our modern institutions has the discipline or the range to help us answer, including what must be some of humankind's most important questions. Why does the universe exist? Why do we enter these lives on Earth? Why do we have so much to deal with in our lives? Or to wrap up all our greatest questions into just one all-encompassing question, what's it all about? Thanks to the work of afterlife researchers and thanks to our determination to finally figure out how everything works, we can now propose good evidence-based answers to all of humankind's greatest questions. Of course, these answers aren't going to be the ultimate answers. If it were that easy, we'd have figured it all out a long time ago. And while we are in these bodies, we have only limited use of our vast eternal minds. But truly, open-minded research is already bringing us preliminary answers, and it's hinting at even more gigantic truths. So what I'm going to tell you now has to be considered something like a beginner's understanding. Here is what seems from all the evidence to be true. The whole universe, our lives on Earth, and all the stressful things that happen to us here, all of it exists for the sole purpose of facilitating each human being's spiritual growth. We'll be talking about what spiritual growth actually is in the next segment, but this is a gigantic discovery. My fellow researcher, Craig Hogan, calls this material reality Earth School. I refer to it as a spiritual gym. We strip down to a limited use of our minds, and we use a lot of spiritual stressors like a job disaster or the death of a child as something like the machines in a gym. It all works to help to strengthen us spiritually. Of course, it doesn't matter whether life on Earth is a school or a gym. We know now that this universe exists to empower us to further raise our own consciousness vibrations, and that looks more and more to be the only reason why this universe exists. We talked in the sixth segment about how we plan our lives around spiritual growth, and you may have scratched your head and said, huh? For all of human history, the word spiritual has been a religious term. It sounds to us in the 21st century like such an unserious word. Until now, the smart people, the scientists, have been sure that matter is all that matters. But, as you know, some of the greatest physicists of the 20th century, people like Albert Einstein and Max Planck, already knew, or at least they suspected, that consciousness actually underlies it all. Whether mainstream science gives in and follows their lead next year or 50 years from now, the greatest scientific breakthrough of the past few centuries is their discovery that consciousness is all that exists. And any researcher with even a half-open mind can find support for that insight everywhere. Still, material scientists are dragging their feet, but you and I don't need to wait any longer for them to wake up to reality. We know now that we enter these lives on Earth so we can experience stressors that don't exist in the astral plane, and thereby we can better grow spiritually. So far, so fun. Now let's look at what spiritual growth actually is and how it happens. Segment 14, Better Understanding Spiritual Growth. It was only when we afterlife researchers began to make sense of the greater reality and how it seems to work that we could even grasp the central importance of what I'm about to say. And if the term spiritual growth seems too religious, let's just call it something else. Mental empowerment, maybe, or human enrichment. Feel free to call it whatever you like. But spiritual growth, or whatever you want to call it, turns out to be a simple matter of consciousness physics. And as such, it can be described in 10 quick points. First, what we experience in a dim way as human consciousness is all that exists. Everything else that seems to be real is a product of consciousness. Second, all our minds are part of the one universal consciousness that manifests all of reality. Third, since consciousness is a kind of energy, it vibrates. Fourth, we experience the vibrations of consciousness as emotion, from fear and anger at the lowest and slowest to perfect love at the highest and fastest. Fifth, in the greater reality beyond this physical universe, we experience the various vibratory levels of consciousness as physical-seeming dimensions. Each is a part of the astral plane that makes up most of reality. Each separate vibratory level may even be a separate non-material but solid-seeming universe. Sixth, we can be comfortable in all those gigantic non-material realities only when we ourselves are vibrating at a rate which is the same as or higher than the vibration of the place we're visiting. we try to go higher than our own vibration, we experience the more rapid consciousness vibration as an unbearable battering. Seventh, most people living in the afterlife and in the astral plane seem to be vibrating just below the middle of the consciousness range, in the group of frequencies that we think of as level 3. That's the level where people generally enter the afterlife. It's the lowest of the three beautiful Summerland levels. Eighth, the many realities in the afterlife and in the astral plane are more beautiful, more joyous, and much more love-filled the higher we are able to go. So naturally, we all get to the point of wanting to vibrate higher and be able to visit some of those even more wonderful places. Ninth, in order to go higher, we ourselves need to be vibrating higher, and it seems from all the evidence that there is a kind of learning process required. So, tenth, this universe exists to give us a place to carry out that learning. And since all our minds are part of the one mind that manifests everything that we think is real, when each of us elevates our personal consciousness vibration, we also very minutely raise the consciousness vibrations of everybody else. That last point is important. Our talking about how far the world has gone wrong is beyond the scope of these 15 segments that are meant just to educate you about death and the afterlife. But I would be remiss if I didn't mention what is the most important reason why you should take the time to learn and internalize all this information. Really, give yourself the chance to learn enough that you can live from love alone and be free from fear. By doing that, not only will you make your own life a lot happier, but your personal elevation away from fear and toward love will help to raise the consciousness vibrations of everyone else on Earth. You can make yourself a lot happier, and you also have the power to help to make this whole world a freer and much happier place. It's important to stress the fact that serious researchers are pretty confident about what I've said so far, but from here we can see there's a lot more to learn, and one of the questions that I don't think that anyone is yet even trying to answer is, where is all this heading? Is there a universal end point? What is it? And how will we be able to tell when we get there? My own opinion, based on 50 years of study, is that there is no limit to humankind's spiritual growth. We never will reach an end point. I suspect that we who are still incarnating on Earth are at a fairly low level of spiritual development. This is spiritual grade school, perhaps, but whatever it is, this is where we are now, and the most important thing I have learned in all my decades of doing afterlife research and trying to understand what's going on is there are twin certainties that we are eternal and that each of us is more perfectly loved than we can imagine. Let's focus on that. There is nothing in this gigantic reality that is many times the size of the physical universe that is any more important than you are. Nothing is more precious. You are extremely and completely loved. This material universe exists and is maintained for the singular purpose of giving you the best place to grow spiritually. You are loved that much. So if you ever need to see proof of just how very much you are loved, take a drive out to the country some night and lie in a field and watch your stars. Spiritual growth is a matter of raising your personal consciousness vibration, but how can you make that happen? The answers that we are finding now might surprise you. Segment 15. Beginning to figure out how to grow spiritually. Any physicist who might be listening must be wincing every time I say consciousness physics. To him, that's like saying dirty cleanliness. Physicists see consciousness as an ephemeral nothing. They see physics as the way you study what is real. But physics is the study of how things work. And the refusal of physicists to follow the evidence and learn what consciousness actually is doesn't change the fact that consciousness is the base of reality. It appears to be more and more certainly true that consciousness is all that exists. Consciousness is the potter who turns the wheel. It's also the wheel itself, and it's the clay the potter is shaping. Your own mind is vast and powerful, and that is true to such an extent that in order for you to work on raising your consciousness vibration, you actually have to get rid of access to most of your mind temporarily. When each of us plans a life on Earth, we strip down to just a limited subset of our mind. Some researchers say 40%. I say maybe 30% or less. Not much. We keep access to some of our mind as what scientists call our subconscious mind, but I call it our superconscious mind. The part that we keep direct access to is designed for rapid learning. Your mind while you're here is dominated by three traits that work well together. It's lazy, it's driven by habit, and it's easily redirected. These traits make it possible for us to get through our day mostly on autopilot without having to stop and think about all the details each time we open a door. And they also make it easy to retrain your mind. What we are aiming for is spiritual growth, which simply means raising the vibrational set point of your mind away from the lower and slower end of its range and toward the higher end. So all you've got to do to grow spiritually at our stage is to teach your mind to automatically react and behave more with love than with fear, and that's it. That's how simple spiritual growth can be. It's simple, but it's not easy. Our natural set point seems to be higher than where most of us are now in these material bodies, so just getting rid of fears will start to raise our consciousness vibrations. But because human societies are so clueless, we live our lives drenched in pointless fears. Laws with punishments, scary movies, even the news with all the world's turmoil, and our institutions that might be of help have instead embraced fear as if it were a virtue. Materialist science defies the evidence and insists that at death you will blink out like a light. In doing that, it puts existential terror at the heart of our society. And don't even get me started on Christianity. It turns out that practicing the teachings of Jesus is the easiest and most effective method for achieving rapid spiritual growth that's ever been found. But Christianity to this day preaches a completely erroneous fear of God, and it hammers us with terror of a hell that doesn't even exist. Rather than helping the world with the Lord's gospel teachings, Christianity is a drag on our spiritual progress. But there are many ways to grow spiritually. The trick is just to find what works for you and then apply it. Your transformation can begin within weeks, and the great news is that any elevation you manage to achieve in your personal consciousness vibratory rate seems to be so easy to maintain that it is effectively permanent. Once you start to grow, you don't easily backslide, and even the process of growing becomes easier and easier. It's my own opinion that by far the easiest way to grow spiritually is to effectively apply the gospel teachings of Jesus, nothing to do with the religion at all, but it's amazing how well and how fast those teachings work. We'll be teaching the most efficient use of them in the members section, but meanwhile, this concludes our basic course on death and the afterlife. As a postscript, you may have wondered why a business attorney has spent the last 50 years trying to understand what happens when we die. The answer to that question is a simple one. When I was 8 years old, I had an experience of light. In the middle of an April night, I woke up in a panic with the realization that there is no God. I was terrified. And then there was a brilliant flash of light, and a young male voice said, "You wouldn't know what it is to have me unless you knew what it is to be without me. I will never leave you again. I swear." When I was 8, that was, I was sure that was probably normal. I just thought, oh good, if you forget there's a God, they remind you, and I went back to sleep. But what happens with these experiences is that they stick with you. Even more than 60 years later, it still feels as if that happened just last night. Something similar happened to me when I was 20, and by then I knew it wasn't normal at all. I wanted to find out where that light had come from, just what is going on that we don't know about. So I began to research the unseen, and eventually I did figure it out. But in the process, I learned so much more. What we afterlife researchers have found is a set of gigantic truths so important that you deserve to know them too. So now you have your own 50 years of truths boiled down to just an hour and a half. And as a member here, you can share in our research. We want you to know what we know. We want you to enjoy to the full the fact that you are an eternal being, beginning with being a lot happier today.